We'll also identify changing conditions and the important issues within the Kirby Valley. And then after we present what we see as the facts, we'll take questions and comments. And mostly we're here to gather information, gather kind of a local slant, how you people see the issues. This is not really a public policy hearing, per se. It's not an official hearing. And it's not... we can't really discuss any kind of pending applications, any water right applications that are out there right now. That would be unfair to do, and that's not the the purpose of this venue. So if I might introduce some of the people who make presentations tonight, some of the people here representing the Division of Water Rights. I think you people are very lucky. We have some of the best water people in the state up here right today. The first one is Boyd Clayton, standing in the background. He's our greeter and light man. And he is a deputy state engineer. He's the number two man. Kent Jones, our new state engineer, was not able to make it tonight, and he would have loved to be here. He had a previous commitment. But Boyd will help us with any of the questions that we have afterwards. There's also Will Atkin, who is our northern regional engineer out of our Logan office. Mike Handy is one of our senior geologists, and tonight he is our scribe and our recorder. Again, my name is Matt Linden. James Greer is one of our senior groundwater engineers for technical services for the Division of Water Rights. And Dr. Hugh Hurlow, on the far end, was the main author of this study. And he'll be giving you a presentation on the science of the study. And Mike Lowe is also from the Utah Geological Survey. And he assisted Hugh and helped put together this whole co-op agreement. And I also should mention that Neil Burke was also assisted in authoring the study, and his name is on the cover page of it. He doesn't work with us anymore, so. But nonetheless, they'll present this study, but with the emphasis on number one, declining groundwater levels and spring flows. Oh, there he is. And this is Neil Burke.
Oh my gosh!
Being one of the co-authors,
you're giving the talk to.
No. We forgot to tell you.
I forgot to prepare.
So again, we'll be looking at declining groundwater levels, and we'll also look at declining groundwater quality in this area. And I think it's very interesting, this project, these issues, exemplify some of the classic Western water right concerns. Number one, there are two states involved, Idaho and Utah. How many people here are from Idaho? Anybody representing Idaho today? One gentleman in the back. Okay, great. We'd love to hear from you. Number two, we're seeing the interface between groundwater and surface water, a classic scientific study, at least. And number three, we're looking at the competitions between agriculture and environmental use, natural resource use, the agriculture and the flows down at locomotive springs. And so... I think we should remember that, you know, we're here to present the science that we've developed, but we're also here to get your input. So we can all, you know, maybe save our questions to the end, and then afterwards we'll have a good question and answer period, and we can discuss some of it. So we'll start off with James Greer, who will present some of the water right history and some of the policy issues.
Could you get those lights back there? Is that make it easier to see? Is that too dark? Is that all right? Yeah. So I'm gonna roughly go over the history of how the policy has been defined in the Curlew Valley, and just present some of the statistics of water rights that we have in the valley. Just so we're all on the same page, here's a brief map. When I refer to the Curlew Valley, I refer to the drainage that drains into the Curlew Valley. So we have Snowville here, the Utah-Idaho border right here, up to Holbrook, over to the Black Pine Mountains, Raft River Mountains, down to the Great Salt Lake, Locomotive Springs down here. So all of the information we'll be presenting would refer to this whole area as a whole. And I'll be calling that Curlew Valley throughout the presentation here. So, the policy history. So, 1967, the state engineer then came out here and held a public meeting on December 7th. At that meeting, Curlew Valley was essentially closed to all new appropriations. No new water rights were issued at that point. And at that meeting also, a cutoff date was implemented that proof had to be submitted by August 31st, 1972, and no more extensions of water rights would happen after that point. Then in 1969, technical publication number 25 came out. The USGS, this is a report that was done by them, kind of just describing the hydrologic reconnaissance of Curlew Valley. This was kind of in response to them closing the area. They wanted to study the area a little more. So that came out in 1969. In 1972, in lead up to this proof cutoff date, another public meeting was held, January 20th, and that cutoff date for proofs was modified. They were given an additional 2 years if they started drilling wells in 1972 and in 1973. In 1974, a new study was completed by the United States Geological Survey, Tech Pub number 45. This one was sponsored by the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and the USGS. This study was a pretty landmark study. It was the first real big hydrologic study that was done in the valley. He will talk more about this, but it's what defined the three flow systems in the groundwater system that are referred to quite a bit. After the study came out, another public meeting was held by the state engineer's office on March 12th. And at this public meeting, the valley was once again opened up for small domestic filings for new water rights or stock watering. This proof cutoff date that was implemented was eliminated, change applications were restricted if you were moving from one flow system to the other, as was defined by this report by the USGS. 1993, quite a bit of time later, another public meeting was held on March 15th to discuss future management alternatives in the valley. Once again, in 1999, another public meeting was held to discuss a hydrologic data report that was developed by Division of Water Rights. That was held on March 3rd. And now, again, in 2008, the study that we'll be presenting today was released by the Utah Geological Survey, which was sponsored by the Utah Division of Water Rights. So Idaho, their policy, in 1972, they had their own study that they did, basically on the Curlew Valley, but just from the Idaho border north. That was done by their Idaho Department of Water Administration, which is the equivalent agency to the Utah Division of Water Rights. Based on that study, in 1976, they did a small internal open file report. And then in 1976, they declared the Curlew Valley a critical management area in Idaho. So that essentially closed their area to any more appropriations for water rights from the Idaho State Engineer. And that happened March 15, 1976. They still allow small domestic applications, but no large applications will be approved by the Idaho State Engineer. Then in 1994, Idaho did another summary report of the Curlew Valley. One of the main conclusions of that report was they felt that the valley was not in overdraft, at least on the Idaho side, and that they haven't seen any significant drawdowns occurring in Idaho of the groundwater table. So just to review, in 1967, the state engineer of Utah closed the valley to new appropriations. In 1974, it was opened back up in Utah for small domestic and stock watering applications. But there was a restriction put on change applications. 1976, Idaho closed Curlew Valley to groundwater appropriation. This is how the current policy stands now today. It hasn't changed since 1974 in Utah and 1976 in Idaho. So, now I just we're just presenting a few just of rough statistics and just some information from water rights side. Essentially, there's around 255 total water rights in Utah, in the Curlew Valley. When I say Valley Spring, there's 25. That's just springs that are located within the valley area of Curlew Valley, not up in the mountain block. So we aren't including those. Idaho has 18 water rights on springs and 129 underground water rights for a total of 147. So roughly there's, 400 water rights in Utah and Idaho in the Curlew Valley. Utah, we could calculate, based on the water rights, based on our information, how much diversion has been approved in Utah, and how much of that diversion is approved to be depleted. Diversion essentially is how much water you can divert for your uses, and depletion is how much of that water you can actually use up or deplete or remove from the system that won't be returned. So this is just on the Utah water rights, and these are pretty rough estimates, but we have about 83,000 acre-feet of water that is approved to be diverted in Utah, either through underground sources or those valley springs. And then from that number, about 69,000 acre-feet can be depleted, approved on permitted paper. Just to look at that diversion over time, how that happened, as you can see, it kind of tells a good story about the valley. Not much activity happened until the early 1900s, and then really in the 1950s did an increase of the development occurred in the valley. And that happened on until this time in 1967 when the valley was essentially closed. And since then you've seen a small increase in just small domestics and stock watering it. And small applications since then. A rundown of the water rights in the valley. Essentially, 71% of the total use is for irrigation. There's some small stock, some small domestic, very small municipal and domestic, and then another 27% of the use is for wildlife habitat management, based mostly down at Locomotive Springs. If you look at the percentage of the water rights. based on these reports that came out by the USGS, essentially this one that was in 1974, they estimated that the Curlew Valley has a recharge of about 74,000 acre-feet that goes through the groundwater system each year. We know we have an estimate in Utah that about 36,000 acre-feet is pumped each year from the wells. That's an estimate that USGS does. We're not sure. There hasn't been any estimates done in Idaho. But we do know that we have permitted about 40,000 acre-feet of pumping, 40,000 acre-feet of water to be depleted from pumping of the wells. And the Idaho, a rough estimate, that they have another 54,000 acre-feet that could potentially be depleted from the system as they fully utilized all the rights, the water rights that have been assigned or given out for a total of 94,000 acre-feet. So if the full utilization happened, that would be more than what is recharged. And just to get a brief idea, we took aerial photography and digitized how much irrigation was occurring in the Curlew Valley in Utah and Idaho. The Idaho side aerial photography was from 2004 and the Utah side was from 2006. But in just roughly digitizing that out, we saw that Idaho currently irrigates around 34,000 acres and that Utah irrigates around 24. Just shows that there's a lot of irrigation taking place, and there's a lot of irrigation taking place on both Idaho and in Utah. that's basically all the information that I was presenting today. Just a brief rundown of where the policy is and how we've got here, and just some information about the water rights and how and what we have permitted to be used here in the valley. But that, we want to take questions now for a little bit if there's any, or want to wait for the
end. Is there anything specific that you would like to know right now on this, or general questions we'll save for later? Okay.
Of the 34,000 to 24,000, did you split it out into how much was being withdrawn for those irrigation practices in the different well systems?
No, we have not done that. We could look at that, but we haven't separated it out. And with that also is the fact that we don't know of these acres which is being supplied by underground or a surface. It's just the total irrigated acreage in both areas.
Back that up one more slide,
yeah,
if you would. So, if I'm reading that right, our recharge is 74,000 acre feet, and we're using 94,000 acre feet. So, are we completing the supply by 20,000 acre feet every year, or what is that slide telling us there?
That's a good question. Well, if you were fully utilizing all 94,000 acre feet, yes. What we're seeing, of course, this is a pretty rough estimate, the 74. But we're seeing only currently, this is what's permitted to be used on paper. That's what you have rights to. But only right now we're seeing that Utah side's only pumping 36,000 acre feet. So they're not using their full allotment at this point. And that's also pumping numbers, and this is how much they could actually utilize and deplete. So as far as Idaho, they could be around the same situation. So it's
potential.
There's potential that you could. If it's currently happening, we'd look at water levels, and we start seeing some water levels go down. So you would think that could be happening. But yes. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
In your recharge number, now are you differentiating between the recharge going into the underground and that portion of the runoff, let's say, that doesn't go underground but is in the surface system and runs down the creek and is irrigated from surface?
No, this is from the report, this is what just reaches the underground main aquifer in the underground.
How are they determining that?
They have many different methodologies to determine that, and it is a very rough estimate, yes. But I mean, we could go into that later if you had more questions, but they determine that through their report, through some scientific methodology. There's a way that they do it.
They've got special glasses to see underground.
Yeah. They just do basically a big, large water balance. They know how much precipitation is falling. They kind of take the rough area. They estimate how much is being taken up by plant use, how much is going to the rivers, and what's ever left over, they assume is going into the groundwater system.
Well, I guess that was part of my question, was that they're seeing how much has fallen in the areas and whatever. How are they telling what is staying on the surface and what's going clear to the underground? I'm not seeing how they're differentiating that what's coming from the clouds and whatever way they can do that. And, well, you probably, hopefully it's covered later.
We can talk about it a little bit. We can talk about it after too. But they have methodologies to try to estimate that, yes. And it is the best science that we have. But it is a hard way. It is difficult.
This is over how long a period that you've reached this average?
This average? This is a long-term average that happens yearly. So they think about 74,000 acre feet recharges each year. But it was just a...
Given on a 10-year, 20-year, what? How do you maintain that average? Because like you said, you've maintained your water flow, from your clouds and your snow over a given period. You just, each year, you just average it in. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think. Maybe Hugh can go that in more detail later.
No problem.
He'll have some slides to talk about that a little bit later. Right. But yeah, if he doesn't answer that, definitely come up and talk to us after. We can answer it. We'll let Hugh go then, get more detail about the report.
So, we
go to the next. Oh, let me set the other. Okay. All right, so this is the report. It's big. I didn't bring any copies for you, but it's available for free on the Utah Geological Survey website. You follow links to groundwater and then publications. And as was said before, the study was sponsored by Water Rights, by Utah Geological Survey, and also in part by the United States Geological Survey. And so I was the principal investigator, and I did most of the geology and geophysics, and Neil Burke, who's here, did the geochemistry for the most part. All right, so as you can see, it's a big report. There was a lot of pretty complicated work that went into it, and I don't have a lot of time. I'm not going to try to explain everything that was in the report or the report in a lot of detail, so I'm going to try to move through it pretty quickly and just hit the high points. And so it'll be kind of abbreviated, and some of the stuff I won't have time to explain as thoroughly as I might normally like to, but we'll just go for it here. Okay, now James already showed you the study area. The only thing I want to add is kind of this is sort of the main part of Curlew Valley, and then to the northwest is referred to as Juniper Valley, and the northeast Holbrook Arm, and then above that Arvin Valley. So those are some of the geographic terms I'll use from time to time. And of course, one of the key areas is going to be Locomotive Springs, and I'll refer to the agricultural areas near Snowville and west of Snowville a number of times. So, as I said, there were a lot of different things to do. The principal goals of the project were to characterize the geology of the valley and of the aquifers that store and transmit the groundwater, and also characterize the chemistry of the groundwater and answer some questions about some of the groundwater issues that were occurring in the valley. So I did some geologic mapping, and that's the part that was sponsored in part by the United States Geological Survey as part of their state map program. So I compiled a geologic map of the whole basin at a new level of detail that hadn't been done before, and I posted it over there on the wall. That's kind of the big, complicated version of the of the geology. I looked at the subsurface structure of the basin fill aquifer, the aquifer from which everybody draws their water and which supplies the water for Locomotive Springs, and I'll explain a little bit about how I did that. We looked at trends of water levels and spring discharges and water chemistry over time. I looked at the basis of the delineation of the flow systems and possible sources of where the water from Locomotive Springs is coming from. And we tried to make some progress on some of the problems, the reasons for some of the groundwater problems that the valley has been experiencing. So I did,
didn't go away.
A combination of my original work and compilation work. James talked extensively about the study by the U.S. Geological Survey. I'll refer to that as Baker 1974. Will Atkin did a later compilation of groundwater data. He's there. And then there was a study commissioned by the Bear River Water Conservancy District by Dr. Bob Oakes of Utah State. And he did a lot of compilation of the data in the Utah part of the valley. And that was a very nice report. In addition, the U.S. Geological Survey annually measures water levels in wells and some chemistry throughout the valley, and they publish an annual report with their results, and they'll show water level trends and things like that for various wells. And then on the geologic side, I just wanted to acknowledge Roger Hogan. I don't know if he's still there now, but when I was dealing with him, he was at BYU Idaho, and he let me use some unpublished geologic mapping that he did, and I want to thank him very much for that because it covered a huge part of the area that had not really been mapped otherwise. And then David Miller from the U.S. Geological Survey has done a lot of mapping in Utah, and I used his work extensively. So this is the simplified version of the geology. So again, here's Holbrook Arm, Snowville, Juniper Valley, the main part of Curlew Valley, and Locomotive Springs. colors don't differentiate terribly well on this, but the dark grays are the bedrock that's exposed in the mountain ranges surrounding the valley. These are mainly limestones and sandstones, and they're fractured and folded up to various degrees, and it's these fracture openings that allow infiltration of rainfall and snowmelt that falls in the mountains. That infiltrates into those fractures and flows downward towards the valleys and recharges the basin-fill aquifer. So the water that is pumped and discharges in the valley, for the most part, is recharged into the aquifer systems high up in the mountains and then flows through the fractures and then into the sand and gravel and volcanic rocks that are in the basin-fill aquifer. For the most part, the rest of the valley is composed of sedimentary deposits, sand, gravels, clays. Some of it deposited by Lake Bonneville when it covered the area 30 or 40,000 years ago, and before that, old river systems and alluvial fans that were shed off the mountains. There are also some volcanic rocks. The purple color is basaltic volcanic rock down there by north of Locomotive Springs. And there are some other varieties of volcanic rock exposed in the Wildcat Hills and up in the northern part of the study area. So there are volcanic rocks interbedded with sediments in the basin-fill aquifer, especially within the Utah part of the study area. The mountain ranges, again, these don't show up too well, but the mountain ranges are blocked out and uplifted by fault zones right along the break and slope between the mountains and valleys. These fault zones lift the mountains up and depress the valley floor, and as the valley floor is going down, sediments shed off of the mountains and fill up the basin. And that's what created, that's basically how the basin fill aquifer was created over time. So there are some fault zones throughout the valley along the mountain range margins. And I think especially the ones down along the Hansel Mountains in the southeastern part of the valley probably allow for transport of groundwater through the fault zones toward Locomotive Springs. And there are some other fault zones that I think play key roles in groundwater transport in the valley, and I'll talk about those as I go. Okay. I drew a number of cross-sections through the basin fill aquifer using the logs of water wells. There aren't a lot of wells in the valley, and they're concentrated only in the agricultural areas, of course, but I use those wells to kind of look at the structure and the layering within the basin fill aquifer. And in addition to that well information, I collected gravity data throughout the basin. The red dots are data points that I collected. I've probably talked to many of you here in the audience now about getting on your land and driving around, and I appreciate the access very much. There were a couple other data sources that I used and combined them all together in the to look at the gravity field in the valley. Now, what that does is the gravity field below an area of bedrock, basically solid rock, is greater than the gravity field below the area of the sand and gravel aquifers. In other words, the rock, the ground below you in the mountains is a lot more dense than the ground below you in basins. So you can look at that difference in gravity, and here and there, if you have water wells that tell you how deep the basin fill actually is, you can put all the numbers together, the variations in the gravity field together, to get an estimate of how deep the basin fill aquifer is throughout the valley. And I use that in some other ways, as I'll show you in a moment. So that's the basics of how I use gravity to look at the subsurface structure of the basin fill aquifer in combination with the water well data. So this is an example of the kind of data. This is the gravity field. What I should do is show you where I'm going to show you two cross sections. One is here through Juniper Valley across the Sublette Range, Holbrook Arm, and up into the Hansel Mountains. That's the first one I'll show. Then I'll show a traverse from Snowville down to Locomotive Springs. Okay, so here's the gravity field on that northern traverse. You can see the gravity values are much lower above the valleys and much higher above the mountain ranges. And that reflects the presence of less dense material below the valleys. So this is kind of a model to show you how deep that basin fill, less dense sedimentary aquifer is in these low gravity areas. This is vertically exaggerated. It's stretched so you can really see the contrast. So these browns and yellows are the basin fill aquifer here. And this is a thick sequence. And probably really only this bright yellow area of the basin fill is usable as a, as an aquifer. But the whole basin is quite thick. Here's a one-to-one scale cross-section so that the vertical scale is the same as the horizontal scale, so it more closely represents the real geometry of the basins. But again, you can see these thick deposits below Juniper and Holbrook Arm, and then bedrock in the mountain ranges. And then I translated these into geologic cross-sections showing fault zones that seem to block out the deeper parts of the basin fill and define the mountain ranges. So you can easily imagine this fault zone, in this fault zone, this part of the mountain, with the earth dropping downward, uplifting this range, and creating space so that the sediment can accumulate here. Okay, the cross section from Snowville to Locomotive Springs looks a little bit different. These colors don't show up terribly well, but here below is bedrock, the older limestone and sandstone. And this unit up here is the volcanics that I showed you on the geologic map before. And notice how the gravity here is higher over the basin fill aquifer. That's because the basalt is a lot denser, actually, than the bedrock. And we know the basalt's there because there's a whole series of water wells along that road that show that the basalt's present in the subsurface. So here's the basalt. And just to the north, right at Snowville, there's a major break in the geology where the basalt ends, and now you have sedimentary basin fill. This appears to be a fault zone right through here, and I think it plays an important role in the groundwater story. Locomotive springs are right about here. Here's Baker Spring, right about where the volcanic rocks seem to start to pinch out and thin. And here's kind of a geologic section showing the basalt in the dark color, with Baker Spring here as the basalt kind of feathers out, and then this fault zone here, which I call the Snowville fault zone. So I drew quite a few of these model cross sections along different orientations throughout the valley and compiled them together to make an estimate of the thickness of the basin fill aquifer throughout the entire valley. So it shows thick areas below Juniper Valley, Holbrook Arm, and then thick accumulations of volcanic rocks down in the southern part of the valley, and another thick sequence here. What I've also shown in the red dashes are fault zones that I inferred to exist from the gravity data only. There's no real surface evidence of them, but they're areas where there are very steep gravity gradients, which mean rapid changes in thickness of the basin fill. So I've explained those rapid changes by fault zones. And there's some, for example, here and here. They're pretty long and may well have some influence on the groundwater transport in the area from north to south. And then this is that Snowville fault zone in here that's in a different orientation, northwest to southeast. And groundwater may flow along that fault zone as well. Okay, that's the basics of that. So let's move to the groundwater scene. This slide shows existing water wells in the red dots, both in Idaho and Utah. This doesn't differentiate between irrigation or domestic wells. It just shows you kind of the pattern of groundwater development and lack thereof during the throughout the valley. This is, I'll refer to as the Kelton area, which is also a smaller area of irrigation. The dark blue lines are contours of average annual precipitation. That's derived from long-term estimates of rainfall from precipitation stations within and surrounding the valley. So these are periods of records from as early as, I think, 1910. And many of them started much later than that, 1950s, I think. And then there, the rainfall, the stations are in the valleys, and the rainfall amount is extrapolated upward into the mountains just based on fundamental relationships between elevation and precipitation. So that's where they get those rainfall or precipitation and recharge numbers that they use to estimate the recharge into the basin fill. It's long-term averages of precipitation, and then looking at typical relationships of how precipitation increases with elevation. The main story is that this is the, what is that? That's the 12-inch contour line annual precipitation. So everything below here is 12 or is less than 12 inches. This is the 8-inch precipitation line. So basically most of the valley floor receives about 10 inches of precipitation a year. Now, in this climate, in this part of the world, virtually none of that actually makes it down into the groundwater aquifer over time. Now, there have been wet years and periods of wet years, especially the early 80s, where there were basically larger pulses of precipitation onto the valley floor. So some of that precipitation just during that time probably did make it into the aquifer. But generally, on average, very little, if any, water recharges. Very little, if any, of the precipitation that falls on the valley floor actually makes it all the way down to the deep aquifer. That up here in the Black Pines, 35, Raft Rivers, 30, deep creeks get up above 25 inches per year. That's where you can accumulate enough precipitation to actually infiltrate into the aquifer systems. All right. This is a contour map and a shaded map of groundwater levels throughout the valley. This is from that report by Baker, so this is old data, but it's the most complete data set with data distributed throughout the valley from the same time range, so I like to use it. And it just shows that water levels decrease from north to south down towards Great Salt Lake and Locomotive Springs. And then it shows an area in here where there's kind of a hole or a downward depression within these regionally gradually decreasing levels. And this is the agricultural area west of Snowville. And we'll see how that changes through time as we look at the records of water levels. These are the three flow systems that James talked about before that Baker defined. He gave them the names of Holbrook, Snowville, Juniper, Black Pine, and Kelton. So the groundwater, the idea here is that the groundwater in each of these three flow systems is more or less separate. It has different chemistry, different water levels, but it's all flowing in the end towards the south. And I've delineated these different flow systems on this slide with lines, but we know they're not hard, sharp boundaries within the earth. They're diffuse zones where there probably isn't much groundwater flow, or the boundaries between the flow systems is hard to define. So they're kind of diffuse zones, mainly in the mountain ranges, where water goes either to one or the other flow system. But within the valleys, they're probably more, the groundwater is probably more separate and distinct. So let's focus on Locomotive Springs for a little bit now. This is an aerial photograph of the area. We were just down there today. Six different springs. These are arranged kind of in a semicircle pattern along the edge of a basalt shield, a set of basalt flows. It's kind of a low feature there, but if you get at the right angle, you can see there's kind of a dome of these basaltic rocks, and the springs come out more or less right along the edge of that dome. And so this is the wildlife area down below the springs. This slide was shown at a meeting. Which meeting was that, James?
The 1993
meeting. On the top shows precipitation. I assume this is at the Snowville stage from 1968 to 1980. So it's just a 12-year period. But you see, over that time period, precipitation is slightly increasing. This is 10 inches per year. So that must be the Snowville, because it's slightly below 10. All right, this green line is the discharge at Locomotive Springs, which gradually declines from about a total, six springs combined, I assume, from about 10,000 down to about 3,000 or 4,000 acre feet per year during that 12-year time period. Meanwhile, well pumpage increases from roughly 15,000 acre feet per year to 30,000 acre feet per year. That's in Utah. Okay, part of my task was to extend these various trends into the present. The study ended in 2004, and so generally my records only go to about 2003 or so. But this mess is annual precipitation, and I've just plotted data from a variety of different stations in the area just to make sure I've got complete coverage. The data run from about the early 1960s to 2003, so a 40-year period of record. We've got stations at Snowville, Park Valley, Arvin, Stowell, and Grouse Creek. So you can see, on the average, overall, precipitation is constant, with this spike in the early 80s, okay, of high precipitation at some of the stations. Overall, precipitation trends during this time period were relatively stable. Now, of course, year to year, there's quite a bit of variation, but that variation varies about a more or less constant line of, this is 10, this is 15 inches per year, so right in that range. Okay, here's the discharge. These are of the individual springs at Locomotive Springs in acre feet per year. Here's Bar M, one of the biggest ones, from 1968 to 2002, declined from 8,000 to less than 2,000 acre feet per year. Also a substantial decline at Baker Spring, from just under 4,000 to hardly detectable, maybe several hundred acre feet per year in the early 2000s. Meanwhile, the pumpage increased from 1980 to the early 2000s from about 30,000 to about 36,000 acre feet per year. So not a high increase, not that same kind of dramatic increase that before, but still some. This just shows a map of water level changes in individual wells during that same time period. The warmer colors are higher amounts of change, not more generally than about 50 feet typically, but these changes range from about 10 to 50 feet in this area. There's some decline in the Snowville area, some modest decline down south. A few wells here and there actually increased during the same time period. I'm guessing that's due to irrigation return flow. Whoops, going the wrong way. Okay. The USGS monitors certain wells annually in the valley, and this is a lot of information at once, but these are some of the records. Up north in Arvin Valley and Juniper Valley, you see the influence of those wet years in the 1980s, but overall pretty stable water levels. Here's one near Snowville with a slight decline. Here's one with Snowville with a slight increase. Now we get west of Snowville. I think this is a 40 or so foot decline. This one, not as much of a decline. 5 feet or so. This is 28 feet. 5 feet. These are all roughly that late 60s to early 2000s time period. So you can see some wells show moderate to minor decline. Some wells show pretty substantial decline during that time period. But overall, the groundwater levels are declining. Looking at water chemistry, these dots are at different sample sites. There are many different sets of data. This is total dissolved solids of the groundwater. And most of the water quality is decent in the valley, less than 1,500 or so milligrams per liter. But there's this area west of Snowville of higher TDS groundwater above 2,000 and reaching into much higher values in certain wells. Not all wells show this. And then the water quality south of Snowville is fairly poor, and moderate to poor in the Kelton area. The chemistry of the water shows trends towards enriched sodium and chlorine in all the different flow systems. The red is the Juniper Black Pine area. The blue are data points from the Holbrook Snowville flow system. And these darker points are the Locomotive Springs chemistry, water chemistry. You can show those are right in line with the chemistry from both of the two flow systems. These are trends in water chemistry. This is electrical conductivity, which is kind of a proxy for how many minerals are dissolved into the water. And again, you can see this varies. Some of the wells are showing a slight increase over time. This goes from 2,000 to almost 4,000 here. This one doesn't show quite as much of an increase. Some of the water quality is very stable west of Snowville. In other wells west of Snowville, this goes from 4,500 to over 9,000 electrical conductivity. And we don't have a lot of data from the locomotive springs, but that chemistry has remained fairly constant. And our sampling in the early 2000s, Heal's sampling in the early 2000s, confirmed that the chemistry is about the same in the locomotive springs. Water temperature is another interesting factor here. It's throughout most of the valley, you have kind of typical groundwater temperatures. The groundwater is recharged in the mountains and then flows down into the valleys. But you have a geothermal area here at Coyote Spring, and then a broad area of warmer water, warmer than usual groundwater in that agricultural area west of Snowville. There could be different reasons for this. Some of that could be that you're, as you're depleting the water table more there, you're drawing up deeper water. You know, the earth is warmer the deeper it goes, and so that warmer that water could be warmed by just the normal temperature increase with depth in the earth. There could be also some extra geothermal feature, some kind of magmatic intrusion that's below the surface there that's giving an extra temperature boost to the water. And part of the problem there is that warmer water dissolves more minerals, so the TDS goes up with water temperature. So that's part of the issue there. We don't know the total cause, but there is warmer water in that same area of water quality problems and declining water levels. Okay, Neil did some more sophisticated he did most of that chemistry anyway, and he did some more sophisticated chemistry to look more closely at the causes of the water chemistry problems and of the trying to figure out where the water from Locomotive Springs is coming from. To do this, he looked at isotopes of different elements in the water, mainly hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Okay, an isotope of one element is different. Isotopes of one element have different numbers of neutrons in their nucleus. Basically, it's a heavier version and a lighter version of the same element. So you can have oxygen with 16 particles in its nucleus and oxygen with 18 particles in its nucleus. Well, how is that relevant? The water molecules with the heavier oxygen, and you can also do this with hydrogen, water molecules with heavier oxygen and hydrogen is heavier, and so when it rains, that comes out more quickly, and when water on the ground evaporates, those heavier molecules stay behind more. That's called fractionation, and it changes the composition of the water during evaporation. And also, different recharge areas impart a different water chemistry signature to the groundwater. So we're going to use this to tell apart different recharge areas and to try to look at how much evaporation has changed the water chemistry. There's also naturally occurring and man-made isotopes that are radiogenic, they're unstable, they decay with time, so the amount of that isotope present in the water decreases over time. And you can use that to try and date the time that the water entered the aquifer, so the date of recharge. And we use two different isotopes. One is carbon-14, the other is tritium, which is a three-weight molecule of hydrogen. So some of the results. First, looking at possible evaporation influence on groundwater chemistry. This shows the heavier hydrogen isotope on this axis and then chloride composition here. So when irrigation water, for example, evaporates, both the concentration of this heavier hydrogen and of chloride increase. So you would expect to see a positive correlation between the two, if evaporation is playing a strong role in influencing water chemistry. The red data points here are from the Juniper flow system, basically the agricultural area west of Snowville, and they show a scattered but apparent trend of positive correlation between these two, which suggests that part of the increasing total dissolved solids in the water is due to evaporation of irrigation water, and then during these pulses of high rainfall, the sediment or the ions that are left behind in the surface soil gets flushed down into the aquifer. So the soil gets concentrated with sodium and chloride during evaporation, and then occasionally when it really rains or snows heavily, those get redissolved and put back down into the aquifer. The Holbrook-Snowville area shows a totally different trend, almost at 90 degrees. I'm not sure exactly what this suggests, but it's a negative correlation. It suggests that evaporation is not playing a huge role in the water chemistry in that area. And then in the Kelton area, we really only have one data point. And the Locomotive Springs data are here, and I'm not sure how those relate to what I've just said. Okay, this plots the two heavier isotopes of hydrogen and oxygen. And basically, you see a positive correlation in modern rainfall. And if just modern rainfall itself, we plot right along this line, but the data plots to the right of the line, which suggests there's an enrichment of these two isotopes in the groundwater. So again, there's a process of evaporation affecting the groundwater chemistry. But what I want to focus on here is that if you plot groundwater data from different areas and different colors here, you see that they plot in different compositional fields. So the composition of groundwater in the Juniper Black Pine flow system, for the most part, is distinct from that in the Holbrook-Snowville area. Right in between them plots the data from Locomotive Springs. Okay. Also, I'm sure you can't see it, but I've plotted groundwater age here from those radiogenic isotopes. In Juniper Black Pine, those ages range from 4,500 to 12,000 years, 3,500 to 12,000 years. And in the Holbrook, there's one sample that's 4,000 and the rest are modern. So the water in the Juniper Black Pine flow system was apparently recharged much longer ago. And the system in the Holbrook-Snowville flow system seems to be more active and is receiving more current recharge into the system. The fact that the Locomotive Springs water plots right between those two suggests that the Locomotive Springs discharge water is a combination of water, a mixture of water from the two flow systems, which makes sense since they're both flowing to the south and more or less converge in that area. Another interesting point is that in the right over by the Stone Hills, in the easternmost part of the Juniper flow system, some of those wells plot have the same composition as the Holbrook-Snowville water. And I'll show you this on a map again. But to me, what this means is that Holbrook-Snowville water is migrating over westward into the Juniper Black Pine area. And again, you can do some analyses and show that it's a reasonable idea. If you take the two starting compositions, mix them together, and get the resulting composition in those few wells. Okay, this is in the report. I realize you won't be able to see a lot of the details, but it's an attempt to pull all of this different information together. And what it shows is hypothetical flow paths towards Locomotive Springs along the Holbrook-Snowville flow system, originating with the recharge up in Idaho. The flow comes south, intercepts that fault zone along the Hansel Mountains that I talked about, and is kind of on the express lane down towards Locomotive Springs. So that's the younger water and better chemistry water. There's older water with higher total dissolved solids in the Juniper Black Pine flow system that also makes its way south towards Locomotive Springs and mixes with that other Holbrook-Snowville water to form the discharge water at Locomotive Springs. However, this water has to cross through this area of pumping, and these contours show the depressed water levels in that area of pumping west of Snowville. It also shows that Holbrook-Snowville fault zone that I identified from the geology, and I think some of the water in the Holbrook-Snowville flow system gets diverted along those faults, moves towards this area of lower water levels, and mixes with the Juniper-Holbrook system in these green dot areas here. So it looks like the large-scale pumping in this area, and probably in Idaho also, seems to influence some of the regional groundwater flow patterns. So that's my main conclusion slide. I'll just kind of let you take a breath and walk you through again what I've done in this talk. The general trends of decreasing water levels and increasing TDS in groundwater and decreasing flow at locomotive springs that have been identified in the past seem to have continued at least into the early 2000s. And I think that this concept of three different flow systems being fairly distinct, albeit the boundaries are a little hard to pin down, that seems to hold up. We think that some combination of evaporated concentration of minerals in the upper part of the soil in the agricultural areas by evaporation and then flushing down into the groundwater of those minerals during high precipitation times, that's one of the contributing factors to the increasing electrical conductivity and total dissolved solids in the groundwater. The other could be drawing up of this geothermal water that happens to be located right underneath that agricultural area, or some of the agricultural areas, by the pumping. I think, again, Baker's flow systems seem to have different starting compositions of groundwater. You can use those distinct starting compositions to look at mixing trends and show that locomotive springs is water, is a combination of water derived from both the Holbrook-Snowville and the Juniper Black Pine flow systems. And also, we can use those same distinct starting compositions to show that there's some mixing probably going on between the Holbrook-Snowville and Juniper Black Pine flow systems just south of the mountain range here. And finally, it appears, if only by coincidental trends of increasing pumping and decreasing spring discharge, that the spring discharge at Locomotive Springs seems to be in response to the declining water levels in the source areas of the springs. That's illustrated in some way by the expansion of this contour of 4,215 feet water levels. Back in Baker's time, this area in light blue and these areas in light blue were at or below 4,215 feet water level. Now, this entire dark blue area is at or below 4,215 feet in water level. And so this, again, this is this part of the source area to Locomotive Springs. That's an arbitrary reference point, but it just shows the changes, the regional change in the water levels over time. Okay, do we want to go to Will, and or do you want to have a few questions?
Well, if there are any specific questions for Hugh right now, we can entertain them. If not, Will will give us a little background on how the policy stands now, and then we can have full questions.
Yes.
You don't show very much of the flow from the Raft River Mountain down that way.
That seems to be not a large contributor to Locomotive Springs. I think we think that what the Raft River system does is more or less stay in this area and flow downward and seep out over a more diffuse area in the Great Salt Lake. So yeah, we didn't focus as much on the Kelton area, except to show that the trends of decreasing water level and increasing total dissolved solids do continue in that small agricultural area there.
What's the elevation of the spring?
4,215. So that's why I chose that reference point.
Okay, and then what's the elevation of the water over the Snowville-Holbrook system?
Well, let's go back to that slide. Okay, we have the 4,800 foot, 5,000 foot contour here, 4,600, 44 something, 4,215. Here's 4,220.
So it still has some head on it.
Up here, yeah, definitely.
And even down below.
Yeah, yeah, some. Yes, definitely.
All right, Will, if you can give us a summary of the Northern Office's perspective.
Well, I,
you may want to kill that fucker. Or do you want to leave that one up?
That's a great one.
Or they may have questions about specific slides, so
okay.
You can leave the presentation.
Okay, if you're okay with that.
I don't have much to add. It's an interesting study that's been done by the UGS that we helped fund, and he referenced some other studies that have been done previously, Bob Oakes, the Baker Report. But you guys are the ones who live here and who drilled these wells and pumped these wells, and so we're here to hear your comments on what you've seen tonight, or your experience that you can maybe add to what these guys have presented. Is there any questions or comments? Yeah.
Well, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but in 1993, when they held that meeting out here, and there was definitely concern by the wildlife as to why Locomotive Spring was, you know, not recharging and where their water flow had gone. They had raised so much concern that they was talking about shutting our wells off out on Snowville Flat. Of course, Water Rights Division here in the state of Utah helped temper that some. But in this new study of what I'm seeing, because in one of the reasons that they were able to diffuse that some is because the study in 1974 that was done, they said that there was that the drainage coming from the Snowville Flat, we call it, was not affecting Locomotive Spring. But according to this study that they just showed here now, they're saying that it is.
Do you want to feel
so
that?
What changed from 1974 to now? I mean, the technology has changed enough that you're convinced that the water that's being pumped on the Snowville Flat is definitely taken away from the flow of Locomotive Springs.
And maybe, Hugh, what you can do is just contrast your study with the Baker study and Bob Oakes' report, maybe.
Right. Baker and Bob Oakes both thought that the Holbrook Snowville system, that eastern system, was essentially the contributing flow system to Locomotive Springs. But we've shown that it probably can't be alone, that there has to be some contribution from that other flow system, the juniper black pine flow system, because of the chemistry relationships that I tried to outline. So there's water coming down here to Locomotive Springs, but also some coming in here. And we tried to see what the relative proportions were, and Neil did those calculations and actually thought, I mean, based on what we saw, we thought there was more contribution from the juniper black pine system. I'm not sure how ready I am to fight for that one. But the main point is that some of the water discharging here does seem to clearly come from this more eastern flow system. And so it makes sense then that if you decrease the head potential from part of the source area to the discharge area, that the discharge would decrease.
But Hugh, in contrasting with the Oakes study, did Oakes look at the water chemistry or the radioisotopes?
He did not look at isotopes. He looked at the chemistry. And I don't recall specifically what he drew from that, except to say that he did not think this was a contributing area because it had such different chemistry, and I agree with him. He emphasized this fault zone as a source, and I agree with that. Yes?
You talk about the in the chemistry and the isotopes and whatever, that's way over my head. Other than
yes,
I thought I understood that
the study of the water coming off of the black pine juniper area was older water.
Yes.
Meaning that, it takes a lot longer to flow down. And it seems to me like, and the stuff coming down on the east side was modern water.
Right.
So it seems to me like the timing effect of the water coming through the Snowbelt Flat is like much slower. So let's say that if it's that slow, that something we're pumping today, the impact may be 20, 30, well,
in terms,
years, 300 years down below.
Yes.
And the only other impact you talked about, some of flowing over from the Holbrook Snowbelt, that may be adding, if there's any impact at all, it's still coming from that eastern side. It's still not the origination of the problem for Locomotive Springs isn't really coming from our from the flats direction. It, there may be a little flow coming out, but it's still a mixed flow, still coming out with the modern water. So it's still telling me that that flow right through the flats isn't really affecting it directly.
There's a difference between when a particular package of water flows from here down to the spring. That's one thing, and that does take a long time. But flow at this spring is also due to a pressure head difference now, so that the water is higher here and lower here. But now, even though the water sitting here isn't moving much, if you lower it, you've lowered that potential difference, and you've lowered the driving force.
So slowing up even more. Which means to me it delays the impact even farther.
Well, you can transmit that pressure difference in a shorter amount of time than it takes the actual water to physically move from one spot to the other. It's like if you had, trying to think of a good analogy with pipes. I'm trying to think about this. If you had two tanks connected by a pipe, and you open the pipe, the flow rate depends on the height difference between the tanks.
Sure.
But if you change, if you lower the higher tank, then the flow rate will be higher.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It still backs up what I'm saying.
Well,
it lowers, it slows it down even farther. And it matches up with what you're talking about, the being much older water.
Yeah, the flow is slower, but the response time is quicker than that because the pressure difference transmits through there.
I don't understand the pressure difference. It seems like the head lowers. You're lowering the head, which means lowers the pressure, which means it doesn't flow south as fast.
Yeah, okay. We're just about on the same point. Yeah, but the time effect is quicker than it takes for the water to physically move.
Why would it be quicker? Because you're slow.
Because the pressure is basically transmitted through the aquifer, whereas the water is moving much more, physically moving much more slow.
Okay.
It took me a long time. Yes?
Just a question. You talked about the chemistry of Holbrook flow moving to the west. Can you tell if the reduction in Locomotive Springs is a product of the Holbrook flow moving to the west, which lowers that flow, or if it's more of a product of the Snowbelt Flat not contributing to the flow? Can't be answered based on the data you have, but I'm just curious if you can see that in your chemistry data, what would be the contributing factor? Holbrook to the west, or just...
Well, I guess it would stand to reason that if the Holbrook flow system is the main contributor to Locomotive Springs, then that diversion would have more of an effect than anything that's happening in the Juniper system. I wish we had a better fix on the relative proportions of the two as at the emergence at Locomotive Springs. And if we did, we'd be able to say more. We'd be a little more quantitative about that. You had a question?
Well, we farm on the flat, so we're west of town, and you're talking about quality of water.
Yeah.
And you're saying that because of the chemistry of the water that you're getting down at Locomotive Springs is why you're assuming it's coming from the Juniper Black Pine.
Right.
Because there are wells that are out there that are higher sodium, and there are some wells out there that are as nice and sweet and low. And
yeah,
that are
strange.
So I have a problem with the fact that you're saying because of the chemistry that's, you know, that you're tying necessarily, because in the 74 they said that it did, that the Black Pine drainage did not affect locomotive. And now you're saying because of the chemistry, but yet the chemistry out there with, I can take you to several different wells, that it's night and day.
It's a different, it's not actually that chemistry I'm using now for the relative contribution argument, is the isotopes, which doesn't change. Now, one way to look at it is, okay, here's the water from the Homer snowbill system on this plot. If that was the only source at Locomotive Springs, the Locomotive Springs water would plot right there with it. Now, here's the other likely source that's mixing with this water and pulling that composition down toward it. Now, how much of this water does it take to pull that composition down this way? You know, Neil thought most of the water is from Juniper. That's what his mass balance calculation indicated.
Yeah, based on some, you know, ultra-simplification.
But we're backing off of that a little bit, don't you think?
Yeah, I would agree.
It just shows there's some significant contribution.
Well, I was going to say, if there's that much flow coming out of the Holbrook snowbill onto the flats into the supposed lower area, then our quality of our water should be increasing. We haven't seen that happen.
That's a good point. I don't know if we have the records over time from those wells where I said there was mixing, and compare those with the other wells. The whole, you know, that whole area is confusing because some wells are great and some aren't. And I think it would, to really understand that, and this was a huge study area, and it wasn't just, I mean, maybe some of you are feeling a little picked on here. You know, I wasn't really focusing on that area. Yeah, I kind of don't blame you, but there was no intent in this at all. I think, you know, if you really wanted to understand it, you'd go in and really focus on that area. Look at the depths of the wells with good versus bad quality. See what geologic formations they're in. Do it really systematically. Make that kind of comparison that you talked about. Might help, but that's another step.
You bet.
Yes.
This is kind of a picture of today. If you were to take the same picture, a light picture back in 1969, when the flows of locomotive were higher, would have trended to be more recent water. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, maybe the same amount of water that always came out of the Juniper Black Pine is still coming out of the Juniper Black Pine, and you'd have far less coming out of Snowbill Holbrook. This doesn't tell you that.
Yeah, it doesn't. All I would say is that water levels have declined in the Juniper Black Pine much more than in the Holbrook Snowbill, and so that potential, that's the more likely candidate for decreased contribution.
Is there any correlation or any information that, I believe it was in the late 70s or early 80s that we had the earthquake?
Oh.
And up in Holbrook, springs popped up that had never been there before, and some have subsided, but, you know, what's the correlation with Mother Nature messing with the...
The problem is you see that trend in decreasing flow just go right through all the ups and downs in precipitation, earthquakes, changes in, you know, various changes throughout the valley. It seems to be a large scale. And so you might, if there were an earthquake, you might see different discharge at one particular spring. But when you see it at all six, that tells you... Plus, the water is flowing to that area anyway. An earthquake's not going to change that. It might change exactly where it comes out, but it's not going to change that potential difference in water level that drives that regional flow. Scott.
One of the questions I had down there is your flow boundaries. So you've got the one flow boundary going down between the Stonehole Brook, Juniper Back Pine, between down through the vault, the salt stuff, the cones, which to me, if I looked at it, indicates there is some kind of structure down there. And like you said, a lot of the springs come up around the bottom of the base of those flows, especially a little bit further
right
to the east. Did your geophysics, what did that show? I mean,
that's where I'm headed. Yeah. Here's
what did you see? Because it just seems like it's not the sharp left turn for groundwater from the other. I mean, I understand your chemistry to see, but physically, when I look at the boundaries and that.
What, this?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, that's a line that represents a diffuse and, you know, hard to define, hard to pin down.
Did the gravity show much with, or did you do much cross there through the.
This is a distinctly thicker accumulation of basalt right here, and there seems to be a very sharp boundary right here. So what that says, if that's a likely candidate for a flow system boundary, possibly. I didn't propose that in this, mainly because I understand, you know, the flow system, you're really trying to pin them down. I mean, ideally, you would have a series of wells going right across here. But
is your line coming down through the trend of those, kind of the axis of those?
I think it's probably on the topographic high, which is arbitrary. But I wanted to put it somewhere just to illustrate. Yeah, that might have been a bad decision. Maybe I should have done what Baker did and just kind of labeled the two areas.
That's what always is his bad question to me. Is it coming from that and taking that left turn down, or is it diffused through that?
It's not totally arbitrary. I mean, there's, you know, these were based on water level contours as well.
So I agree with your boundary. I mean, I think that's pretty important for us.
Yes.
So what's your reasoning on this Idaho water, why you think your flows haven't decreased up there? Because it could be possibly because some of that's still being flood irrigated up there.
Mm-hmm.
Versus all sprinkler.
Yeah, I think we also have much more diffuse, that's kind of a double negative. We have fewer records from Idaho as well.
Well, I don't know why the two states can't work together. I mean, I don't think there's...
I'm not complaining. I'm just saying we have records from DOL.
Well, that's what I'm complaining about.
Okay.
The two states won't work together.
Yeah.
We can't seem to work on anything, but I think there probably is a direct correlation that you do have flood irrigation still going on at their water storage, and
mm-hmm.
so that is recharging our aquifers.
You know, also, this is the main recharge area, and so there's a lot more water coming into the system up here than down here. So any withdrawals you take are likely to be captured. You're kind of capturing that recharge at its source more so than in Newtown.
So can you put a percentage on what decline there is? You say that that it's declining and that you're measuring that. I'm curious to know where you're measuring it, how you're measuring it.
Of which? Decline of which?
The decline of the water flow.
Oh, all I can really document is the decline in discharge from the springs, and show the timing of that relative to the declining water levels. As far as the percentage, you know, of contribution, I don't think we know that well enough to really even put a number on it. So if the water from the Juniper Black Pine flow system is a relatively small percentage of what's coming out at Locomotive Springs, then a decline in this source area won't affect Locomotive Springs as much as a decline in the Holbrook Snowville area would.
That makes sense.
But we don't know those proportions, so it's hard to pin that down. Yes.
Could I take the meeting a little bit different direction for a second? One of the things I've been concerned about as I've watched the area over time is the seemingly decaying water quality west of Snowville. And I was just curious if that's a concern to you, if you feel like it's getting worse, the area of bad quality water is getting worse, or you feel like it's stabilized? I'm just curious.
Well, and that's what doesn't make any sense. There are some wells that are really nice and doesn't seem that their water quality is not bad, but then there's a definite area where it is definitely worse. But a nice well can be, you know, directly, you know, geographically directly south of one that's not so great, and it's a really nice well. And then you have, you know, one that it has, you know, the higher, you know, faults in the whole linear. So geographically, you've got them here, but it seems that they found in the that there is one place where, you know, whatever's in one certain, you know, the one area are definitely worse. But then, like I say, you've got one well, and there's one that's directly south of it, that the quality has not changed.
Do you believe there's an increase in the number of wells that have water quality problems over time?
No.
No, I've been out there. I've been out there 33 years doing this, and I can take you to the wells that I wouldn't want to take a drink out of, and I can take you to the wells that I can still go get a drink out of, and
that are very nice.
That are very nice.
So it's got to be somehow flow is.
And that's why I'm interested in why they're saying the water. I mean, that we've got a decline, and the reason that I question that some is that in checking the log on the wells when they were drilled on several of the wells that we've pumped, we've had pulled for one reason or another to have the poles reworked or whatever needed to be done, static water table on a whole bunch of those wells haven't changed 3 feet in 30 years. If you measure them basically at the same time. Yeah, if I pull a well in November and I've been pumping it hard from the 1st of May until the end of September, and I pull it in mid-October or something to have some work done, we'll go in and, yeah, the static water table will have changed 15 or 20 feet. But if I go in and check it in May, or if I go before we start, or in April before we start pumping, most of the time, the static water table on those wells is sitting within 2 or 3 feet of where it was when those wells was drilled 30, 40, 50 years ago.
In my compilation of water level plots for the wells that we have time records of, show that. They show that some wells have stayed steady and some have declined. And I can't help to make sense of that. One thing I also did was I plotted well depth versus total dissolved solids to see if there was a trend of, you know, decreasing water quality with depth, which is common, and there's no correlation. The only thing I see here is that a lot of the bad wells are at about 400 feet. Bad quality water quality wells are at about 400 feet. But not all of them are. That's the only kind of consistency.
Most of those wells drilled earlier 400 or 440 feet, and I can take you out there and take you to a number of wells that I can take a bottle of water out of it and set it there and set a bottle of Arrowhead water or whatever you like to drink right next to it, and I dare you to tell me the difference.
Yeah. And at 400
feet. And they're drilled to the same depth. 400, 440 feet.
It does not. I've got ranges in TDS from, you know, a few hundred at 400-foot wells to over 6,000.
Yeah.
So.
Dennis, follow up on Boyd's question about water quality. There is an area, you know, around your hot well that's on the Idaho side, that there's some land that's gone out of production in my memory.
And that's what I was saying. There's
right.
one spot
there,
where you
area.
Have
there's
an area down. Where it has... It's bad, but that hot well that you're talking about was pumped for maybe 2 years, and that's all it was pumped?
Because it's hot.
But it hasn't been pumped since.
But the water quality around that, there's
you've probably got a section of ground that's gone out of production, right?
Two sections of ground now. Yeah.
But, well, we've got that one well just to the east of there, still in Idaho. And it's really not bad, and it's called water and a whole business. It doesn't put half a mile, three quarters of a mile west of that well? East of that
yeah,
well. East of that
right.
well.
East of that well, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, that's really strange.
Are you testing it at all, quality-wise? Do you know if it's changing?
You know, we haven't tested. We just bought the place a year ago, so we don't have a lot of old that kind of test data. But it's we just had the pump reworked, and the well's fine.
But it's hurt.
Okay, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it makes no sense because right in that area, we know that there are four wells that were definitely bad. Directly south of it, here's a well that's just really nice, and it doesn't make any
sense. But there has been some deteriorating water quality to the wells in the wells that are west and south of the hot well. And that's where the land's gone out of production.
Right, and that's
yeah,
in that.
Yeah, right there.
Still
yeah,
in that
yeah,
area.
Yeah.
But at the same time, well, not every well has shown a decline in water level. There is a, you take a few steps back overall in that area, the water table's being depressed continuously.
Is there any chemistry in, or what there could there be, in those wells down around that area that could tell whether you're getting uploaded along that fault? Comes through there?
I haven't looked at it in that level of detail. Like I said, if you wanted to go back and do a more detailed study, you could probably try to sort that out.
To follow up one of Dennis's comments, have you done any testing on the same well, fall, and then spring to check the water level to compare how it does fill back up, recharge up?
We had some of that, didn't we, from the Department of Ag samples? You did some of that.
Yeah.
I didn't present that because I didn't understand it.
Well, the reason I asked the question is my experience is on the South Platte of Colorado, Alluvial Aquifer, and when we pumped our wells along there, and I had 50-some wells along there, if we check the drawdown or the pump down on it in the fall would be as much as 8-10 feet. By the next spring, it's always back up again.
Oh.
It would always fail.
Yeah, there's one well.
Let's see here. Where are we headed?
Oh! Looks like they had pretty continuous monitoring in one of these wells. It shows that annual fluctuation.
Yeah.
And it defines, I mean, so there's the annual fluctuation, but if you kind of look at a mean, there's a few feet of, not much, but a few feet of decline.
Are those from the USGS water?
Yes.
Yes,
they try to measure at the same time every year. So
right.
But if that's in the fall, it's consistently low then.
But they measure in the
spring and
fall. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Any more comments on the report? Or?
Well, I do have one question that does concern me a little bit. I mean, just how we were all a little nervous about what was going to happen when the feds found out that there felt like that the flow from Juniper Black Pine was affecting locomotive springs. Now they got some ammunition, it looks to me like. So how much trouble are we going to have now, and what kind of a fight are we going to have when they get their hands on this information, or if they already have, maybe you can answer that question. I'm a little curious. Maybe I'm being a little pessimistic here, but definitely when we went through that, there was a lot of concern. The state water rights, you gentlemen stood behind us, and it kind of went away. But I worry now that maybe they got some new ammunition to come after us and try and do it again.
Well, we're not here to set policy today, but they did want to come out with this new study, but. You know, we'll hear from you, I'm sure, in the future about policy.
Aaron, do you want to say anything? You have one in your hands.
Yeah.
This contains no comment on or discussion of policy. My idea was to get the data out and see what the trends were, update everything.
Has there been any current discussion with Idaho on basin-wide recently?
No, there's not. The latest contact with Idaho that I know of is when you guys tried to contact them about the Idaho well, and they basically said no comment. And they pretty well ignored us.
Well, because Because in the early 70s, and we're talking before even this study was done, there was a meeting that was in American Falls that was between Idaho and Utah. There was a gentleman's agreement. I was there, so I know it was done, and they have completely ignored it.
In fact, we have a letter that said there was no gentleman's agreement.
And of course.
Right.
But they're not doing anything.
So anyway, there's not a lot of cooperation from that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, wasn't there in somebody's comment that on that in 94 that Idaho came out and basically said there was no overdraft in that area or something?
Yeah.
So maybe that's what they're saying. They don't care because it looks okay to them.
Yeah, basically they reported and looked at water levels in Idaho. It was only about three wells and they didn't show any large declines, so they basically came out and said, we don't see this in overdraft. We don't think it's an area that we need to be concerned. They didn't go back and open it back up. It's still closed for large appropriations, but basically the state engineer there decided we're not going to spend any more resources here.
Anyone speak to are there changes in Idaho as far as what they farm, how they farm, as far as flood irrigation, sprinkler irrigation? I know that, and there's a difference maybe between the Holbrook Arm and the Juniper area. Any comment on that?
You probably haven't seen very many acres decline. I don't think there's been any decline in acreage. There's probably been a little more shift to sprinklers, from flood to sprinklers.
Is that on the Holbrook side?
It's on the Idaho side, which I think is kind of funny. Here you got the government here wanting you to put pivots in, but yet then they got another arm of the government here wanting you to recharge an aquifer, pump water back down a hole. Why don't we go back to flood irrigating a percentage of acres, you know, recharge these aquifers? So, you know, it's kind of a catch 22 deal.
Tom, what about the Juniper area? What could you say about that?
I was going to say, we do got a stock well out there to be able to live dry last year. But a new pump, and it needs new pumping. It was already dry.
Okay.
Well, I was just curious, from this report and the 74 report, what are the differences between the two? I mean, you have more information, but the conclusions aren't a lot different. I mean, the idea is that there was contribution to the springs from Juniper, Black Pine, Snowball, Holbrook. Didn't know the relative contribution. I didn't hear anything different than that today. I mean, this gives you a little bit better idea of what the geology is, those kinds of things. But I don't know if it's the tool yet to change any policy. Anyway,
okay. Anybody else want to comment on the report? Or?
But I don't see there's a lot of difference.
Okay, appreciate that.
It's just refreshing of what we've already been told.
Well, good. If anybody needs this report, it's available on our website, waterrights.utah.gov. And also, all our names and addresses and phone numbers and emails. If you have any other comments that you want to send us, we'd be happy to talk to you on the phone or look at your emails. We appreciate your attendance. We appreciate your attention here. And I imagine this is a conversation that will continue.